Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So you're going to really enjoy this conversation with Rand Fishkin, one of the smartest people in the digital marketing world, period. Rand is the founder of SparkToro, and he was previously co-founder of Moz and Inbound.org. He has dedicated his professional life to helping people do better marketing through the Whiteboard Friday series, his blog, his book, Lost and Founder, which is really great. So we wanted to talk to him since he's one of the first people to predict how big search engine optimization would be to our lives. I wanted to get his perspective on the future of digital marketing in this wide-ranging conversation that veers off on tangents, as all good episodes do. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Alrighty, Rand, thank you so much for making the time to talk to me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, gosh, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
I have so many questions, and I'm not going to be able to ask you all of them. So I think I know a lot about this, but I think a lot of people who don't know would be interested in a little bit about your backstory. You know, how do you get from point A to point Z career-wise and entrepreneurially?
Sure, yeah. So I dropped out of college in 2001 and started working with my mom, Jillian, on a business doing web design. And eventually we struggled with that business and couldn't pay our subcontractors. And so I had to learn SEO and found that practice to be really, really secretive and challenging to learn. And so I started this website called SEO Moz, where I shared kind of my experiences trying to learn SEO. Yeah, eventually that started attracting a lot of traffic and interest. And I kind of pivoted us into being an SEO consulting business from web design. And in 2005, I think we shut down the old business and switched entirely to SEO Moz. And then in 2007, we launched some tools, just some ones that we had built for ourselves around SEO, and put up a little PayPal subscription. And 6 months into that, our little subscription to our tools was doing more revenue than our consulting business. And so we went, hang on a second, this might be exciting, and switched to being a software business. And at the end of that year, raised $1.1 million from Ignition Partners and Curious Office here in Seattle. And I became the CEO. And for the next 7 years, grew Moz to about $30 million in revenue, and then stepped down in 2014 and was an individual contributor at the company for the next 3.5-4 years. Just left recently to start a new company, SparkToro.
Okay, nice. Very succinct. And I think one thing that probably a lot of people don't know is, you know, especially if you're not in the SEO world, I guess the best description would be like, oh yeah, so I know LeBron James a little bit. You know, if you say that to a basketball fan, if you say to, you know, anybody in the SEO world that you know Rand Fishkin, they're like, wait, are you serious? And I mean, I kind of feel that, what do you think it is about the SEO world that makes people who are nerdy, and I'm including myself, what makes us so attracted to the ins and outs and the intricacies of SEO?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, it is this wonderful combination of art and science, right? There's a bunch of technical things about SEO and lots of mystery and intrigue about, you know, why Google does certain things and trying to sort of reverse engineer their processes. And then there's also a huge amount of art and creativity in, you know, how you create content and how you market it and reach people and earn their amplification and awareness. Both of those make me very attracted to SEO. I think they attract a lot of people to SEO. But at the same time, you know, the SEO had a shady reputation for a long, long time, probably until only a few years ago. You know, if you told people you were an SEO, 9 times out of 10, they'd say, oh, that's a really, you know, really sketchy world, and I don't trust anyone there, and I've had bad experiences there, and you know, isn't that stuff all against Google's guidelines? And can't we just, you know, if I just make things good, you know, content on the internet, Google will figure the rest out. Like, why would I ever need SEO? And that has finally culturally shifted, I think, in big companies, small companies, startup world, professional environments of all kinds. But man, it took a long time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think That's in some ways, you want to talk about a long time. I think let's not take a long time to get to know you specifically. This is our lightning round where I ask unexpected and off-kilter stuff. So basically, nobody has any idea what questions are being asked going into this. So are you ready?
Let's do it.
Okay. I'll start with a softball. Favorite city for you to speak in? I know you speak often. So what's your favorite city to speak in?
Ooh, I have a lot of cities I love to visit. One of them is definitely Valencia in Spain, Kyoto in Japan. That's an amazing city. But I think my favorite city to speak in is San Diego, California in February when you just need a dose of sun.
Okay, so basically not Florida in August, you're saying?
Yeah, I would really prefer not to be anywhere, but I think Seattle is the only place. Maybe Seattle and Edinburgh are the only places I'll go in the summer, I guess.
How the hell do you get your facial hair to look so consistently awesome?
My facial hair? Genetics, I'm going to guess. I don't do anything fancy.
Okay. Well, if you saw my Jufro during the summer in New York, you know, people will know this is how I fell in love with beauty products, is just the very fact that pretty much nothing cooperates without me forcing it to. So
I see. Yeah.
Envious.
I definitely benefited from the low humidity environments that Seattle offers in the summer.
Okay. So note to self, move. Got it. And how about also want to ask you favorite website to waste time on, since I know you spend a lot of time continually educating yourself, but when you want to basically get stupider, where do you spend your time?
Oh, it's all Reddit for me, man. I am kind of a Reddit addict. I think I visit that site probably more than I should.
Oh, I think that describes anybody on Reddit, including myself. So yeah, totally agree. What is something that you've never revealed about yourself in an interview before?
I don't know. I've been interviewed a lot. That's a challenging question.
Something that, to the best of your knowledge, you haven't.
Okay. The first job that I ever had in college, I worked at the Wizards of the Coast Game Center on University Way in Seattle. And I was a receptionist, like at the front desk. I bought a lot of Pokemon cards with my employee discount and then resold them on Craigslist and eBay. Because Pokemon cards were very hard to come by unless you were at, you know, one of those stores, and made enough money to pay for like 2 quarters of college.
Nice. Okay. All right. See, this is how we get to know people. And then let me ask you, this ties into kind of going back into the more serious stuff, but biggest mistake as an entrepreneur where it was just a mistake. It wasn't like because you know how everybody's like, let's learn from our mistakes nowadays, but sometimes you just make a mistake and you don't necessarily learn from it, or it wasn't a teaching opportunity. So has there been anything like that for you?
I think I often get a little caught up in my own sense of self-righteousness and then sort of lash out in unhealthy and unproductive ways. I'm not sure that I have totally learned from that yet. I think that's something that's still coming for me. I still have a lot to learn about how to do that best.
That's fair. And I think it's probably bigger than a lot of people, you know, just to be able to admit that, it's kind of the first step in modifying it in some way, right? So I love Lost and Founder. I love that you put together something that's a painfully honest field guide to the startup world. And how do you get the idea to share your story, and how did you decide on the approach of just being, you know, straightforward and truthful, that it's not all going to be roses, you know, as you're getting your startup up and running?
I mean, I think this came from personal experience, because one of the least helpful things that I found was this culture in startup world around, you know, everyone saying, oh, I'm always crushing it, I'm killing it, you know, we're doing amazing. And then, you know, behind closed doors, it was sort of actually, this is really tough and this isn't going well. And there's all these hard things. I really hated that. And I felt like the culture of only talking about the positives and of, you know, over amplifying sort of this message of positivity, made me feel really alone. Right? Because I felt like I was the only one struggling. And then when I'd have conversations privately sometimes with other people, and I'd share that I was struggling, then I could hear that other people were as well. And so I think we need to have a little bit more of an honest, open conversation and a lot more media and a lot more stories about not just how hard this is, but what the failure feels like and where it happens and what specifically happens and, you know, who benefits and who doesn't benefit. I think those things are really important and really healthy. Yeah, I think Lost and Founder came out of that desire to share stories of struggle and failure and not just doing amazing things.
It's interesting, actually, because, you know, before I was even going to be talking to you, I had a conversation with Dave Kirpin from Likeable Media about Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade and some of the other recent, you know, entrepreneurs who, you know, needless to say, it's a very lonely life in some ways being an entrepreneur. And I'm not saying everybody is, you know, prone to suicide or suicidal thoughts, but I think that it is really one of those things where nobody quite realizes going into it how much of a roller coaster it's going to be. I mean, at least from the people who I've spoken to, they kind of think like, oh yeah, it is going to be that crushing it mentality. And they don't think about how low the lows feel because it's your company, it's your baby.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. There's definitely a huge correlation between people who are, you know, who pursue entrepreneurship and those who have suffered from or will suffer from anxiety, depression, emotional issues, you know, mental health problems. And I don't know which way the causation runs. I don't know whether it's you are likely to have these things and so you hate being a cog in a machine and you need to go do your own thing, or whether it's, you know, the stress and pressure of the of this world drives a lot of people who enter it to experience these issues. Maybe it's both. I'm not sure, but definitely I think one of the things that helps the most is when we stop shaming people for having those feelings and stop making those conversations unacceptable to have and making it not okay to say publicly when you're struggling and not okay to talk to whatever, you know, your investors, your board, your executive team, your co-founder, your employees, your customers. Like if we can make that more of an okay thing, like, oh, my parents are sick and I need to take care of them. That's a conversation that people are willing to have, right? They're open to it. I got diagnosed with, you know, testicular cancer. Okay. But that's a conversation we're willing to have. I am suffering from severe anxiety and depression. Ooh, you are not a strong leader and, you know, we probably need to make a change. And that's bullshit. That shouldn't be the case. We need to stop that.
You know, in some ways, actually, that ties into the idea of companies that have an Achilles heel and they have to modernize and essentially future-proof themselves. They have to go in a different direction. Do you want to penalize the companies that realize that they have a gap that they have to address? And obviously, the answer is no. The market rewards those companies over the long term for being able to realize that they're fallible and that they've got problems. And, you know, so in some ways, it's kind of inconsistent of us that when there are leaders that realize that they're fallible and they have certain things that they want to be honest with themselves about, I'd like to improve on this area. I'm being honest about the fact that I am, you know, down because being an entrepreneur is difficult. That's something that we should really embrace. And I think that that's being a strong leader to be able to admit those things as opposed to a weak
one.
So, okay, now that we've depressed the hell out of everybody, in all seriousness, I wanted to ask you, because I think SparkToro, when we're talking now, is pretty new. And it was really, I loved actually, you know, hearing you speak recently. We were just speaking at the same conference, a few months ago. And I love that you're like, don't go check out the website. It's like, it's a work in progress. We're launching a new thing soon. You're going to love it, but it's not there now. And now I've kind of been able to see through the formative stages of getting a sense from afar to understand SparkToro and what the mission is and what you're looking to do. So, and also, frankly, the fact that you have such a great track record of being able to predict what technologies are going to be big. That's why I feel what you're doing now has got to be very relevant to people. So what in essence is SparkToro?
Sure. Yeah. So basically we're calling it an audience intelligence tool. We don't think there's a great term for exactly this practice that we've all done, right? So if you've been an entrepreneur or a marketer, or you know, you've tried to attract an audience to something, you know how it goes, right? You figure out who your audience is, and then you try and figure out to whom and to what do they pay attention, right? What podcasts do they listen to? What YouTube channels they subscribe to? What events do they go to? Where are they geographically that I could reach them? What media do they watch? What blogs do they read? Who do they follow on Twitter? All those kinds of things. And then you go do your marketing. You might try and, okay, let's see if we can, you know, sponsor this event or be a speaker at this event. Could we be a guest on this podcast? Could we, you know, submit a piece of content to this blog that we know our audience reads? And could we get in front of this account on Twitter and see if they would amplify something for us? And all those kinds of things, right? Or we could, you know, we know they follow this page on Facebook, so we're going to run some Facebook ads to people who follow this page, that kind of thing. And figuring that out, just that discovery process, is a horrific pain in the butt. I've watched a ton of people do it. It is slow. It's manual. It's days, sometimes weeks of work. It usually means doing a bunch of Googling and searching on all sorts of networks and, you know, and Google itself. And then building a big spreadsheet and then trying to estimate, you know, reach and traffic and all these kinds of things. And it's just silly. You know, it looks like SEO looked in 2002, where you had to check all your rankings manually. And, you know, the only way to find links was to Google it. And that's crap, right? So we thought, you want to reach interior decorators on the West Coast of the United States? Great. You should be able to enter interior decorators, hit enter. We should give you back a list of, here's podcasts, here's Twitter accounts, here's events, here's Facebook pages, here's blogs, here's websites, here's, you know, journalists, here's whatever it is, right? All these different sources that influence your audience. And you should be able to, you know, check them and make a list and do that in 5 or 10 minutes. It's silly that it takes weeks. Data and tools should do this for you.
Well, I think that's so true. And I think what's interesting to me is, just since I've been a lot more in the social world versus the search world, just historically, to me, one thing that seems interesting is that I feel like search kind of matured a lot faster, because I don't know what year you would say was a tipping point in terms of where you could almost trick Google, like when that point was, when you went from you could trick Google to you basically.
Probably 2012, 2013. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it took a while, but still social media has been around for a while. And it seems like you can very much still trick in a lot of ways the social platforms to, I mean, we're talking on, I think, a 24-hour period where a lot of people lost a lot of fake followers or bots or inactive accounts on Twitter, for instance. And this is, you know, Twitter's now been around for almost a decade.
The FBI just testified in front of Congress today that, you know, they found these, you know, millions of Americans who were exposed to messages from, you know, from Russia and other places, who essentially around election influence. And you're sort of like, oh man, these social platforms are very gameable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, and in some ways, hopefully the one benefit of the fact that everything that it has been gamed is maybe people won't allow them to be as fallible going forward. But what do you think the next few years looks like in terms of social data? Will we start to be able to trust it more? Will certain metrics wind up becoming more considered to be more important than certain deprecated or something else?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. My suspicion is the networks, just like Twitter has, you know, in the last 24 hours, I think the networks are going to be cracking down much more carefully. Facebook, you know, has cracked down a huge amount, and they've limited the reach of tons of pages, and they've made, you know, advertising for any page much more transparent, so you can see all the ads that have been run by a page and those kinds of things. They've started to do attribution. They've said they won't take money from all these places, all this kind of thing. I think that over time, they'll probably also ban a lot of hate accounts. And I certainly hope they will, right? And Twitter is getting a little better on that front. It's still taking a long time. LinkedIn hasn't struggled with it as much. Instagram is getting better about, you know, shutting down a lot of their fake accounts and, you know, other weird sources. I think the networks are growing up, and they're also facing the fact that they can be manipulated, and that's making them change behaviors and invest in it. And the public conversation about it is also really big. So this is one of those places where I think all the people who, you know, said, hey, we have to have a conversation about this. This has to be something we talk about. That can make change. That can force change, even in private companies. And it's healthy to see that.
For sure. That made me, you know, think about one or two other things with respect to Facebook. I mean, obviously, we're talking, probably one of the biggest tipping points was, you know, the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what do you think the future for online privacy looks like? Is there some kind of silver lining to Facebook's privacy snafus that everybody's forced to be more transparent on an ongoing basis? And will the customer even care? I mean, are we going to be, I can see this going one of two ways, and I'm kind of the mind that my kids will wind up growing up in a world where they just don't have as much of a sense of feeling like privacy is a right that they're owed. And if they're never growing up in that world, they won't expect it, and therefore companies won't have to give it to them. But I mean, do you think that we're at a tipping point where privacy will be respected and everybody will own their data blockchain in a blockchain style format? Or is the answer somewhere kind of in between?
I don't think Americans care very much about privacy at all. I think other countries, it's different, it's sort of culturally different, but I think upcoming generations, even less so than older generations, privacy is just not an important issue. I think manipulation and, you know, fake accounts and sort of undue influence and those sorts of things, those are issues that I think Americans still care about and talk about. Privacy is not one. You know, I think that the monopoly power that we've enabled and sort of the practice of lobbying that we allow in the United States means that I see a bleak future for people who hope that privacy by default is available. And I think there's a lot of options, right? There's a lot of choices. You can stay off of these networks and you can retain a lot of privacy in those ways.
But is that even really a good option for most people? I think it's this option that 10 years ago was kind of more of a valid option. But the way that I look at it is kind of along the lines of there was a certain point that you remembered your friends' birthdays because they were also on Facebook. And that was a rarity that you were on Facebook and they were on Facebook. And at some point it becomes an expectation. So if somebody has a low audience score, for instance, using one of the tools, the Spark score, you guys can all go take a look at this on Spark Toro's site. You can get the true level of influence for any Twitter profile, which I love, but it obviously requires people to participate in the system. Otherwise, it's very hard for them, for us to really gauge somebody's influence.
Certainly, if you want to take advantage of the network effects of a social platform, I agree that you must be willing to sacrifice some privacy for that. I wish that there were more careful controls. I wish that Americans sort of cared more about this issue and thus, you know, forced the platforms to kind of offer a lot of ways to do this and offer ways to make themselves safe and anonymous. Like I said, I don't think this is something that many Americans truly care enough about. And I think that many of us, even I would say most of us, are willing to sacrifice most of or all of our privacy in exchange for very small benefits. As a result, we sort of get the world that we're in. And look, I think technology might enable, you know, blockchain-enabled security systems to hold, you know, private hashes of all of our personal information. And so we don't actually share any of that with the social networks, but we can still create profiles and they can verify that we're us and all that kind of stuff. I'm not arguing that stuff won't exist. I think it's possible that it will exist. I think very, very few people will take advantage of it. My favorite example of this is there's a search engine that's just as good as Google. It's called DuckDuckGo. It is 100% private. They don't store your searches. They don't use your search history in any way. You know, they don't serve you advertising based on what you've queried in the past. They don't cookie you. It is a privacy-centric search engine, and the results are just as good in most cases as Google. No one's switching to it. I mean, you know, a few hundred thousand people are switching to it. But that is not a point of competitive advantage. Google sort of says, like, we're going to violate the hell out of your privacy all the time and abuse your privacy. But when you perform this search, if you're connected to your Gmail account, we'll show you if you already have a flight and what time for this thing. And people are like, yeah, I want that.
Yeah, that's you're right. I mean, I think it's also one of those things where you need to, if you're trying to figure out where, this is what I always tell people, and if you're prognosticating about the future, try to look to see what people do as opposed to what they say that they do. So if you ask people that they care, so if you ask people if they care, they're going to do certain things. But, you know, they'll say, sure, I'll totally rebel. Or if I had a Facebook alternative, I would turn to that. But the reality is, not really, because you kind of do. And I think the DuckDuckGo example is a great one. So you're very much, I think, kind of like me, in a macro thinker, in that you're trying to study all these different things and look to see where the trends are going, what technologies are going to shape people, and how human psychology factors into people's decisions. So, I mean, how do you get better at predicting the future on an ongoing basis?
I don't think I am a great predictor of the future. I think I'm merely an observer of recent and past history. And to the degree that recent history tends to correlate most of the time with the future, you know, I think you can get reasonable at it. But then there's, you know, every now and then there's, I think they call them like the black swan events, right? And they shake everything up. And I am not good at predicting those. I don't think most people are.
Is there anybody? I mean, I literally, it's interesting. I personally, I don't ever get really worried about the black swan events, because I just think, well, everybody else is going to miss those too. So in some ways, it's like we're all screwed. But when you look at the fact that this is people who are following your Moz work like way back when, we're able to build these really strong, defensible internet properties because they understood something that, you know, I think in a lot of ways, you were probably one of the first people, period, to say Google and the search engines are your customer. You know, like, of course you care about your end customer, but in some ways this large, you know, B2B company is your customer, and you have to make them happy if you want to get that number one ranking for any important keyword or phrase. So I would say don't sell yourself short, but you're right. It is very difficult. And it sounds like part of what you're saying is not to take too long of a time horizon. Don't try to predict out 5 years out, but if you're studying the recent past, you can probably get the next 6 months.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, this is one of the reasons that I love B2B as opposed to B2C, because I feel like in B2C, you have to try and predict the future a little bit better, right? Like, what will consumers want and where's the market going? Especially if you want to have, you know, sort of a big company. In B2B, you just have to serve the existing market better. And so it's actually in your interest not to, don't design for the future of, you know, Salesforce didn't design for like the long-term future of what salespeople needed. They knew that salespeople needed a great CRM tool right then. And they built a great one, and then they've, you know, maintained that and, you know, leveraged their network power and bought a lot of companies and all these kinds of things, right, to make sure that it stays good. But it is not, that's really, really different from trying to say, okay, I think the salespeople of the future will be, you know, socially enabled. And so in 2006, we need to start building social tools into Salesforce. No, they didn't do that. They bought a company, you know, they bought a bunch of companies in like 2012 and 13 after it was sort of proven that salespeople would be doing these things. And then they, you know, then they made these acquisitions, Radian 6 and all that kind of stuff. And for the people who needed them, they included those. I think that you can actually, as an entrepreneur at least, focus more on serving today's customer than on trying to predict the future. I think that's another sort of myth of Silicon Valley. Like, oh, they predicted what people needed. Google was like the world's 17th search engine, maybe 21st search engine, right? It was not the first.
I was more of a Lycos guy. Yeah.
I remember Dogpile and Hotbot, Northern Light, Alta, InfoSeek, right? All these places, right? And they were all pre-Google, but Google was like, this problem can be solved better. We can do a better job of solving an existing problem. We don't have to predict the future. It's already here. Lots of people want to search the internet. The internet's growing. Like, we can do this, right? And then I think they had great timing. They had great luck. They also had a great product. And I urge entrepreneurs not to get way too far ahead of themselves on that.
So, no, I think you're so right about that. I actually wanted to ask you, because probably last big question I've got for you is, I think everybody's trying to ultimately get, like you said, the next 6 months, they're, you know, there's not a lot of benefit in making a prediction 20 years out unless you're a very like a long-term investor or whatever. But how do you correct or control for your own biases in order to better predict the future? Now that we've established nobody can really quite predict it exactly, I think one of the things that's so interesting to me is everybody has certain biases. Like I work in digital marketing and everything that I do tends to have a little bit more of a visual component. And if all of a sudden visuals become less important to digital marketing, it's going to be very difficult for me to admit that to myself. It's going to be very difficult for me to build my strategies in a way that isn't aligned with what my current business, my roadmap is, right? And I advise a lot of people who are trying to, in some ways, acknowledge that they have biases. So, I mean, how do you, as an entrepreneur, as somebody who's learned a lot along the way, kind of just be aware of what your preferences are, what your biases are, in order to almost correct for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can often discover these by looking at things that you're good at and bad at, places where you've had a lot of success in your previous career and places where you haven't. I think you can also ask people around you to be really honest. Say, hey, I'm trying to figure out my blind spots and biases. Can you please help me? Your investors can be good for this too. And this is one of the reasons why it is really, really helpful to have a diverse group of people in your life, right? People who are not just exactly like you, your same age, your same background, your same geography, your same gender, your same ethnic background, your same way of thinking, all those kinds of things, your same skill set, your same school. If you can get a lot of diversity on all of that stuff in your network, then you can ask people and you can see things from different perspectives, and they can give you feedback on that. I think it's also helpful to actually lean into your biases, to basically say like, okay, I know that I am not good at this and I'm really good at this. And so therefore I'm going to design a company that doesn't need a whole lot of this thing I'm bad at and could really benefit from this thing that I'm really good at. So for example, I suck at sales. I don't like doing sales. I hate the sort of inauthentic relationships that are created by sales. And therefore, I build companies that are self-service, right? Where just anyone can go online and sign up and buy the product and check it out with a credit card or, you know, take a free trial or what have you. No need to have a sales process. And that means I don't have to hire salespeople. I don't really have to get good at sales. I can just avoid the challenge entirely. And I think it can pay to recognize those things in yourself and find ways to do it. You know, if finances and financial operations and modeling is something that you're like, gosh, that's a weak spot and I really don't know much about, build a very simple financial model, right? Make sure that you have extraordinarily simple expenses and maybe a single credit card that pays them all and a single bank account, and make sure that you have potentially a financial structure on the payment side where there's only really one way to pay your company and you take all the money in this one fashion and it is all, you know, treated the same way for taxes. And great, you know, now you've sort of end-arounded the issue, and maybe you're missing out on some extra income that you could get. Maybe you're missing out on some, I don't know, cool credit card points or whatever, but you have simplified things to work around your weakness. I think doing that can really pay dividends for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think it's true. I wish I had all the time in the world, because I know there's a lot else I could probably ask you. But I just wanted to also, just so you don't have to plug anything, and you probably wouldn't, but if you guys right now who are listening to this right afterwards, go take a look at the reviews on Lost and Founder. You've got Seth Godin, Nir Eyal, a lot of really, really smart people that you've probably read and listened to a lot are all basically kvelling. I'm going to throw a little bit of Yiddish in.
Yeah.
I'm punch drunk today, but they're all kvelling about Rand's book. So, so see, you didn't even have to say any of that. I'm just doing it for you. Bring me on the road with you.
Oh man, I have not gotten enough Yiddish endorsements, so I need some help on this front. My grandparents are going to be so proud.
Nice. Yeah, that's so funny. Great picture of Rand with his grandparents on, I think it's on Spark Torah, right?
Yeah, on the book page.
Yeah. So go check it out, guys. And Rand, thanks again. This was really, really great.
And that wraps up another episode. As always, if you've liked this one, please take a second to rate us and review us. That's how we get the word out and keep on growing our subscribers from one episode to the next. So until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.